Dental in the Kitchen talks about food. Dental in the Kitchen talks recipes. Dental in the Kitchen talks about lots of other things on
Community Radio.
Welcome to the Dental in the Kitchen. My name is Lana Nuftigal.
And I am Donna Prisgintas.
We gather here once a week around our kitchen table to talk about food, farming advice, recipes, and opinions. And we are here at the studios where our kitchen table resides of KHOI Community Radio in downtown Ames, Iowa. We're in the center of Iowa, the center of it all, and we're glad we have the support and the kind offices of the KHOI Community Radio. Well, so Iowans talk about the weather, and we've had a lot to talk about recently because
drama, lots of drama.
Besides all the politicians blowing in and out of here, we have had an amazing amount of cold weather, and it still is, although we do have sunshine today. So hope you are all well and warm and snuggled in, and we finally got some weather. Boy, we got some winter weather, and that's something Iowans like to talk about a lot anyway.
Well, I have to say, when the sun shines and everything is covered in white, it is really, really spectacular. Mm-hmm. I don't mind.
Especially
if you're sitting inside by the fire and looking out the window, right?
Perfectly. That's good. So the weather is something we talk about a lot here. And
what's the old saying? If you don't like the weather, wait 10 minutes and it'll change
or something. It will. I'm waiting. Okay. Another topic that we like to talk about is food, because this is the Dental in the Kitchen, and we talk about food and farming. So the old cliche of Iowa feeds the world, well, probably not, but people think we do, and a lot of things are grown here on a large scale. There's all kinds of agriculture technology that has been developed so we can exceed our last year's limit on growth and on product and on crops. And, boy, we try to do our best, but it seems like there are consequences. It all seemed like a good idea to expand, and take care of all the things that might be thwarting our attempts at growing all the world's food, but
weeds and bugs and
So there are consequences. Joining us today is Rob Fox. Welcome, Rob Fox.
Hey, thank you for having me today.
Rob was at our kitchen table not so long ago. He's a farmer, and we were talking about turkeys with him before last Thanksgiving. And that was a lovely show on the Dental in the Kitchen. But he's here in a different guise today. He's here to talk about something called the Pesticide Action Network, because in growing all those crops, there have been things developed that we spray on our field. And unfortunately, for many years, we have been spraying and applying things willy-nilly, pesticides, herbicides, and all that kind of stuff.
So Rob got sprayed. Rob is an organic farmer. And, of course, if you're an organic farmer, you don't use pesticides and herbicides. You have other methodologies. But one year, his crops got, you know, an overzealous airplane applicator sprayed you with something. What was it, Rob?
We actually got sprayed by a cocktail of more than one thing. So one of the products was a Lorsban product, so that'd be chlorpyrifos. And then there were a couple of other things. One was a fungicide. And I can't remember what the other one was.
What do they use chlorpyrifos for?
Yeah, chlorpyrifos is an insecticide, and it's used in several products. I think Lorsban would be the most widely recognized commercial name that people would be familiar with, at least in Iowa. In the case of this particular event, there was a nearby soybean field, and they were concerned about aphids and spider mites, so they decided to fly that field on a Friday about 6 p.m., so it was late in the day. and they decided to fly over that field, and the applicator also decided not to turn off their nozzles as they flew over our farm. So it was kind of an interesting, and we're talking about interesting and exciting things because of the weather. This turned an upcoming weekend into quite an exciting event here. I was outside at the time. I was out by our poultry flocks, and of course, when the plane flew over, chickens and turkeys and ducks don't particularly like planes flying just over them, so they went crazy. But they all got coated in pesticides. I got coated in pesticides, and the entire west half of our farm got coated in pesticides. So that was kind of a rude awakening for myself and for Tammy, my spouse, how pesticides can kind of intrude into our lives. Prior to that, you know, of course, we had some concern because we were trying to grow without the use of pesticides. So, of course, you're concerned about it, but you don't necessarily see the evidence of it. If it's an herbicide and you're growing some vegetable crops, you might notice damage to those. But if it's an insecticide, if you're not looking for it, you're not going to see that it was even there. So if you aren't even on the farm and somebody flew over your farm and sprayed it, and you came back, it's possible you wouldn't know it had even happened. This happened in 2012, and that very much changed my attitude, my life. Unfortunately, it takes sometimes big events like this, traumatic events, before somebody really realizes that maybe something's wrong and we need to start acting differently. And that was kind of the big event for us.
Well, when you got sprayed, aside from shock and awe, what were the consequences for you?
You know, I could probably do hours on consequences, but we'll try and keep it shorter. The immediate consequence, of course, was I was covered in pesticides and fungicides, as were all poultry and, of course, half the farm. So the first thing that we wanted to do was figure out, what do I have to do? Because I'm currently covered in things that are probably not good for my health. So we made a call immediately to a doctor who basically told me, well, get out of the clothes and step in the shower and start rinsing off. And when we asked them how long, he said, oh, maybe half an hour to 45 minutes.
Ooh, hot soapy water.
Yeah. Yeah, and get really pruny. That's kind of how that works. But the net result, though, is that people don't always have a real good idea of how you should react after you've been directly coated with the product. Part of the problem here is at that point, I didn't know what was covering me.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody had told me what was being sprayed. So, of course, what are you supposed to do? Usually when there's a poisoning issue, the first question that comes out of the poisoning hotline is, well, what's the poison covered with? What, you know?
Wow.
And the answer is, I don't know. And then the next thing, of course, is we started making calls to the farmer who owned the field. We made calls to the sheriff. We made calls to the airport. We made calls to any place we could find to try and figure out, well, where'd this plane come from? And try and figure out what was going on and what we needed to do. So there was a flurry of activity. Now, you need to remember, this was between 6 and 7 p.m. on a Friday, so most people had gone home. And then, of course, people were going to be gone until Monday in many cases. So calls to the Pesticide Bureau, you leave a message, calls, you know, pretty much that's kind of how it went, is we made a lot of calls to a lot of places, left a lot of messages, and then needed to try and figure some things out on our own. And the truly difficult part about that is twofold. One, we have poultry who lay eggs or poultry for meat later on, and we have vegetables in our fields that have been sprayed. We don't know what they've been sprayed on or what's been sprayed on them. So we don't know what we can do with any of our product, because remember, as a vegetable farm, I'm harvesting things throughout the entire summer, so there are things ready to be harvested now. So what do I do with that? Do I go ahead and harvest it and give it to people and run the risk that somebody gets sick? Are the eggs going to be fine from my hens? I don't know that either. And on top of that, since we didn't know what it was, one of the things we didn't know is that all three of the pesticides sprayed on our farm and on us had do not enter ratings where we were supposed to not be in the spray zone for anywhere from 24 to 72 hours after the spray.
Oh.
So technically, we should have been told to remove ourselves from the farm for 3 days, because that's what the chemical rating is. Is if you should not enter the spray zone for 3 days for one of those products. One was 1 day, one was 2 days, one was 3 days. So with the mix, for 3 days, we shouldn't have been on the farm. As far as health issues are concerned, the immediate health issues I had was I had trouble with breathing. I had to be put on prednisone to try and work through that. And here's a really odd one. I started having trouble with sunburning. One of the things that chlorpyrifos will do is if you're exposed to it, your skin becomes more readily burnable for a while afterwards. You're just more sensitive. And remember, you're talking about a person who worked outside every day from sun up to sundown. And yes, I did use suntan lotion and things like that, but I'm not likely to burn quite as easily as other people. So it was a bit of a surprise to go out there and realize I'd been out for an hour and I was sunburned. And that wasn't something. Plus, I wasn't breathing well. So, of course, maybe I was not paying attention, perhaps. I don't know. But that's the medical side of it that we can attribute directly to that event, is I had some trouble for about a month after the application. But the other thing that happened is we had to throw away and basically stop harvesting all of our produce on the west half of the farm. So we couldn't give that to people, was the net result. And we stopped giving people the eggs from the chickens for about 6 weeks. We couldn't get anybody to tell us for sure how long it would take for them to flush it out of the system. So we went with a conservative approach of 6 weeks, where it's like they should be able to, their system should be able to flush it. We had to move the chickens off their pasture so they wouldn't keep ingesting the pesticide mix. And the other odd thing about this is remember, I'm a certified organic operation. So that meant also that if I took any of my equipment into the half of the farm that had been sprayed, I would have to clean it off before I tried to use that equipment on the other half that was still certified organic, because you do not want any of those pesticides to migrate over into that. So all kinds of crazy things. The list could go much longer, but I think that gives you a flavor.
So that ground lost its organic certification for 3 years then?
Yeah, for 3 years, that half of the farm was not certified organic. So in addition to losing all the produce that we had on that half of the farm, 6 weeks of egg production, we estimated that was somewhere in the neighborhood of 200 dozen eggs. Probably more than that, now that I'm thinking about it. But it was a lot of eggs. And we didn't know what to do with them either. You know, you have all these eggs and you're not giving them to people, and we had to figure something out.
Oh,
we couldn't use the compost piles for 3 years in that area either.
Oh, that's right. Oh, goodness.
Yep, the bees all died. We had beehives over on that part of the
farm. Oh, the bees all died. Oh.
Yep. So a lot of things happened that really... maybe I can summarize this up and close this portion up real well by telling you how I felt at the time. It was 2012 was a dry year. This is something we're familiar with this past year. It was a dry year. And I had been farming since 2004 on this farm as a small-scale diversified farmer. And that's hard work. And I did not have family farming experience that I grew up in. So here's a person who's a computer scientist by trade trying to become a farmer. And by 2012, I was walking the fields the day before this happened, looking at things, saying, my gosh, I think we finally found it. I think we figured out how to do this pretty well. We're figuring it out. I was feeling really good about things. 24 hours later, we'd been sprayed, and for the first time since we started farming, I wanted to quit.
Wow. Disheartening. And were you ever compensated, or the person who made the mistake reprimanded, or I mean anything?
Yeah, that's also a difficult part of the story to explain to people, because you would like to think that you could get help immediately, because that's when you need it the most. Is the point that you have been hurt is the time when you need the help.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, what ended up happening is after initial contacts, apparently the cooperative and the farmer and other folks heard from their lawyers that they should stop talking to us.
Of course.
not that we were being aggressive or anything. We were just saying, hey, what was sprayed? What can we do?
Help us.
Yeah, help, please. But then they stopped talking to us, which meant we had to start asking for legal help, which is really too bad, but it's what happened. The legal process is not fun. We did seek litigation against them and did get compensation 2.5 years later.
Huh.
So let's put it this way. We were still farming, and we're still farming at a different level now than we were then. So we apparently survived it. But the time we needed the help, we got no help. It was 2.5 years later where we've apparently already survived it that we got essentially a compensation amount that was exactly the amount that we calculated we lost in terms of everything. We didn't get compensation for physical health problems, and we didn't get any other damages. Our lawyer said we should have gone to court because we could have probably gotten much more money. But there's something else going on here. Litigation is difficult, it's tiring, it's stressful, and I wasn't in it for punishment. I was in it for we need to not allow this to happen again. And apparently the only way to get people in the area to take us seriously that they should let us know they were spraying or be careful with how they were spraying was to hit somebody in the pocketbook and show that we had teeth. Because simply going and telling people that hurt us, please don't do that again, isn't going to work. And that's not the Iowa I grew up in. The Iowa I grew up in is neighbors take care of each other. Neighbors look out for each other. So this was also spiritually for Iowa a tough thing for me.
Sad. So, and this led to you now being an Iowa of well, you work for the Pesticide Action Network, and tell us about that.
Yeah, it's amazing how life kind of turns. In 2020, I actually joined Pesticide Action Network as a communications associate. So essentially we were taking my speaking and writing skills and saying, hey, I think maybe this guy can actually manage to help with a bigger picture here. And so I joined Pesticide Action Network in part because they have a twofold approach. One is they're trying to fight against the chemical intensive agriculture and food system that we seem to be so reliant on right now. This is the same system that makes it harder and harder for a small family farm to continue to exist in Iowa. And these are the farms that we grew up with. This is the pride of our state, are these small family farms. This is when you picture Iowa, you picture that red barn and the silo, and you have some animals on the side, and you've got a patchwork quilt of crops, and you've got a wood lot. All these things are the things that you picture. And essentially, the chemical-intensive, large-scale agriculture that we're promoting right now is killing that off. The Iowa that we picture in our minds as beautiful is being destroyed. And what I'm trying to argue about here is that chemical-intensive system is counterproductive to us being a healthy state, us producing food. Lana, I heard you mention the fact that we like to pride ourselves with feeding the world. The irony of that is we can't even feed ourselves. We actually import the same percentage of our food in this state as the islands off of Hawaii do. Roughly 95% of our food is imported from out of state for us to eat. So that seems kind of contrary to our mission. On the other hand, we have some of the best soil in the world. And so the other part that attracted me to Pesticide Action Network is they are promoting, as opposed to these large industrial farms, they're promoting agroecology. And the whole point of agroecology is that we're trying to have more farms, smaller farms, more diverse farms. So that each of those farms is growing more than one crop in a field. There's perhaps some intercropping going on, or smaller fields, or longer rotations, all kinds of things that we can do that not only are they healthy for the soil and the environment and require less pesticides or perhaps no pesticides, but they're also healthy for the people in that we're going to want to go out and see the land that we live on. How many people tell you, and you're talking about somebody from Idaho or California or New York, they drive through Iowa and they say, what a boring state. And I'm like, no, Iowa's a pretty state. It's got a lot going for it. We're just working real hard to make it boring by making our fields bigger and growing one crop. Imagine what this state could be like. Imagine how positive we could feel about our place that we live in if we worked a little bit better to have more diverse farms with different crops, with wild spaces, all that to boot. And the other part of agroecology is a recognition that there's a social component to this as well. And part of that social component is getting more people, more diverse people, which includes indigenous folks, black folks, folks of color, basically their own patch of land to do a small farm. And imagine how beautiful our communities could be. We're talking about our small communities dying in this state. We've been talking about that for 30 years. But agroecology says, hey, we've got ourselves a social component to this too. Build those strong small communities with more farms, more people on the land, more diversity.
Well, so Pesticide Action Network is concentrating on the pesticide part of the picture. I mean, so recently there was the book, what was the water quality book? Swine Nation or something like that?
Swine Republic.
Swine Republic.
By Chris Jones,
right. And it's a very good book. If there's anybody left in Iowa who hasn't read it, please do so. It talks about the load of nitrates. Now, everybody has become aware of nitrates in our water. You can't see them, but apparently they are not good. And the city of Des Moines has gone to great expense to remove the nitrates from the water. Okay, so there is a growing awareness, not that we've solved it, of the nitrates. But the other things that are coming off of agriculture in this state that are, I'm sure, not good for public health are all of these pesticides and herbicides and insecticides and things like that. So in what way is Pesticide Action Network participating? I mean, because you can't see this stuff. And as you said, if you're not standing there when the airplane flies over, or and a lot, not all of it is aerial applicated, applied. Thank you. Plenty of it is like seed coatings and other things that farmers just, you know, they've been told that's what they have to do to get what they think they need to do. And how are we going to break this cycle? What do you think? What are the options?
What are the options for breaking this cycle? well, you know, this is a big problem, and it's one there isn't an easy answer for it, and yet there is an easy answer for it all at the same time. I mean, once again, I think the easy answer is, in fact, agroecology. It's the idea of going back to more and smaller farms, where the farmer is more reliant on their ability to put their boots on the ground and walk every inch of their farm and see what the land is asking for, as opposed to trying to make the land into a cookie cutter universe. So one of the things I like to tell people is that we have taken to the idea that we have to modify our land for our agriculture. Adjust the land for the agriculture, and you do that by spraying, you do that by tearing up all the trees on the fence lines, you do that by making your fields bigger. I've even heard of a farmer who tried to take the tops off their hills because they bought a larger unit for seeding, and that thing couldn't actually manage the hills. It would get hung up on it. So they actually took time and moved soil to get rid of the tops of their hills. What we need to be doing is adapting our agriculture to the land instead of the land to the agriculture. And that's agroecology. That's the simple solution. The problem is that we have a lot of money and a lot of big businesses that are selling us with a lot more bandwidth. That's the wrong idea. The right idea is to make the fields bigger, to use more chemicals, to use more genetically modified seed, And unfortunately, we all know how this works. You can be one person yelling as much as you want to, but if you got somebody with a lot of money who can control the airwaves, it's awfully hard to get people to listen.
That's true. That's why we have to keep talking about this sort of thing, because I think we may make a dent if we all decided to address this issue together. You're listening to KHOI, and this is the Donald in the Kitchen, Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. Kitchen. We're talking to Rob Fox about interesting ways that pesticides and herbicides have affected his farm, and probably not for the better. Rob, you talked about a different way of looking at things. Too much of what we do is mining the earth for what it gives us in terms of dollars, and I don't know who can argue with the fact that this probably is not a bad idea, and that seems to show up really starkly in what we've done to the land. The amount of topsoil we've lost, the amount of fertility we've lost, and this is probably going to be important because we need the land to feed ourselves. You talked about being affected by aerial spraying, who decided to not dump things where they were supposed to dump them, but went right over your farm, and not very good results. And I wanted to ask you, is different ways that pesticides get into the system, is that something that, is it always by airplane? And also, we're going through a really cold winter now. Does that mean every spring we start out with a brand new clean slate? What happens to those pesticides and things that are applied to the land? Where does it all go, and how does it keep affecting us?
Some of this isn't studied as well as it should be, in part because we don't require that we study all these things to get a pesticide approved for use. That's one of the issues that we do have. There is in Iowa, actually, I'm going to go a little bit backwards on your questions here. There is actually a couple people who are doing some very interesting studies on some of the breakdown products from some of the very widely used pesticides. Because it's true that some of these pesticides like glyphosate or Roundup, as most of us would know by that, when they make contact with the soil, they do tend to break down into various byproducts. And when a pesticide is approved, they do like to know how quickly things break down, so they get that rate. But at the same time, they do not require that research be done to figure out if those breakdown products are also toxic or if they will cause problems in the future. And what's being found is there are a number of these products that are being found to actually be more dangerous than the initial product was once they're broken down, and they don't break down as fast. So what's happening is that we're starting to get more and more residual materials, not just in our soils. We need to remember that not only do our soils hold these residuals, but they do leach into the groundwater, or they run off with the soil and into the surface water, into our rivers, into our lakes, into our ponds. Iowans may have noticed that it's becoming more and more frequent that our lakes and ponds where we have swimming beaches are getting closed more and more often. And some of that product, and I'm not going to say that it's all pesticides, but some of what's building that up is because of the way that we allow these things to move through our water systems. So that's part of it. But when somebody sprays a chemical, they may spray them with ground rigs. So of course they're closer to what they call the deck or the top of the crop. So the ground rigs will probably drift a little bit less at the moment they're being sprayed, unless of course the person applying it ignores how fast the wind is moving. And I've been noticing around our farm and other places that seems to be something people don't always pay full attention to. But even if they do pay attention to it, there's another interesting story that I think is useful for this conversation. Before we joined PAN, or I joined PAN to work for them, our farm participated in something called the Drift Catcher Program, where we had them build this little drift catcher, and it was put out there during insecticide spraying season. We kept track of the weather, we kept track of who was spraying, and then we would send these little tubes. We take tubes they'd be in there for 12 hours, and you take a new tube, put a new tube in. We shipped them off for testing and came back with positive results, once again for chlorpyrifos, interestingly enough. And the results were high enough that they could have caused a brain injury for a small child or a baby, or perhaps prenatal injury to a woman who was pregnant to their child. And when I looked at the records, I found that this was for a spraying that was over a half mile away from our farm on a day when the wind was coming our direction at, get this now, 5 miles an hour. This is well below the recommended level for spray. So a lot of pesticides, chlorpyrifos being one of the chief ones, can really move even though they're under the conditions that are prime for spraying.
So it's in our air then, not just the water, not just the soil, it's also in the air.
It's also in the air. And the other thing that can happen is we need to remember that how do rain clouds form? They form from the condensation of moisture. It lifts up into the atmosphere, it builds the clouds, and then it rains. Well, do you think it's just going to be moisture that lifts up? Well, it's also pesticides. Oh. So you could get pesticides in your rain. So we're getting it from all levels. I talked to a person with the Pesticide Bureau when they came out to our farm after another drift incident that we had to deal with. And he told me, well, we could probably test the leaves of an oak tree in one of Iowa's biggest forested areas and find residuals for pesticides. You're going to find some sort of residual. If you want to test for all pesticides, you'll find residuals everywhere in this state.
Okay, so are the suspected cumulative effects on humans from living in an environment where we have multiple considerations in terms of pesticides, herbicides,
nitrates?
Yeah, all of this agricultural chemical use. What is it doing to our population? And who's doing anything about it?
Well, okay, that's a big question.
And very
some of
big.
That question is a huge question, really. Some of that question is so hard to answer. I liken this a little bit to the old tobacco industry issue.
Oh, yes.
Those of us who are old enough to remember how long it took and how many studies it took before the Surgeon General even bothered to put a warning on tobacco about nicotine, for example, and the fact that it could cause problems. And so it's the same issue. Because these are all environmental factors, there's so many variables, it's always hard to come up with irrefutable proof. However, we do know that a lot of our primary chemicals that we have that we use in the state are neurotoxins, which mean they mess with neurological development, especially in children. But we also can say and point out that it seems that our farming population, our farmers, have a higher incidence rate of cancer. Ooh. And mm-hmm. a lot of these chemicals are known to be carcinogens. So there's causal effects that are pretty well shown. But when you start getting into the scientific community, you talk about proof, it's hard to make a real solid case that it's all just pesticides because there's always so many variables. But I think what we're finding, though, is we keep doing more research, and as we start allowing research to happen, we find out that it's more and more likely and more true that these chemicals are affecting our health every day. I asked the question, I had a kidney removed a couple years ago for cancer, and I asked the question myself, how much of that is because I work outside every day, year after year, and I get these residuals into my, I have a low dose poisoning pretty much all season long, you could probably say, because I work outside in it. How much of that is because of that kidney cancer is because of that, and how much is it because of other things? I can't tell you, but it sure does make me wonder.
That's true. That's true. And there seems to be a real paradox here. I mean, there's the reality of what these chemicals and things are doing to our bodies. But then again, like you mentioned, people have this funny idea and about the beauty of the rural life, how ideal it is and how, well, they think it's healthy if you're outside working, and the thought of the rural farm with the red barn and everything. It's pretty amazing that our brain tells us one thing, but the facts seem to be telling us something else. Unfortunately, I'm afraid the myth, let's call it the myth of the bucolic rural homestead is still sort of affecting how our national policy about what we fund, what we regulate, with the flurry of political activity in this state, good old Iowa, during the past caucus that we just had. Oh, people like to talk about how salt of the earth we are and how what a nice place this all is, but it seems the facts on the ground seem to be a little different.
Well, I think the problem is that all of this stuff is invisible. You can't see it. You can't feel it. You don't know it's there until it's, you know, too late. Oops, you have cancer in your kidneys. Who's supposed to be protecting us from this? The EPA?
Yeah, that's a great question. And again, that invisibility factor is part of it. I mean, if you don't immediately get ill, let's
say if you can't see it and you can't smell it, it doesn't exist, right?
Right. So if you're not throwing up or your leg isn't falling off or something immediately afterwards, you don't think about it after that. And that's why I'm saying the big event on our farm of getting sprayed and me getting coated in pesticide was a big event. Because I saw a very direct effect, and it motivated me to more action. And part of the reason I joined Pesticide Action Network is because I don't want either of you or anybody else to have to go through the same experience to come to the conclusion that we need to be making changes. We should not have to make every individual in the world experience these things so that we change what we're doing. Instead, we should change what we're doing so people do not have to experience these things. So the question is, who is responsible for this? And it's really, we've made this a more difficult question than it needs to be. The EPA's job is to approve the uses of pesticides and set standards on the labels for these about how they're supposed to be applied, and that if you do apply them wrongly, then you can be held liable or responsible for the problems that causes. But the EPA has nothing to do with the enforcement of these labels. Each state instead does the enforcement. So Iowa has their own pesticide bureau, and that pesticide bureau is responsible only for enforcement. And their job is merely to investigate a reported incident to determine whether or not the use label was not followed. And then they have very, very small fines. The fines are limited by the state, and those fines are not enough to actually prevent co-ops or other individuals from deciding to go ahead and spray anyway. The biggest thing that can happen is if they get multiple records of where they have been abusing the use labels, they could get their license taken away. That's probably the worst thing that can happen. But otherwise, it's generally pretty easily brushed off as a cost of business.
Okay, so in the medical community or in the, you know, like the Center for Disease Control, is anybody looking or trying to limit some, obviously whatever is killing all of the bugs, the insecticides, has some toxicity that gets into humans and other animals and everybody. I mean, it doesn't just kill the bugs. What's the system to, like, for example, every once in a while you'll hear, such and such, what's that one that they're trying to regulate its use or forbid its use and then nothing happens? Or where does this go in the legal system?
Well, I can give you an example. And we'll just, because I've talked about chlorpyrifos more than once today, we'll use that as our example.
Mm-hmm.
Chlorpyrifos has been known for a long time to be a neurotoxin. It's been known to drift pretty easily for a long time.
It's a bug killer, right?
It is a bug killer, okay. Yes. So it's an insecticide. And so it's been known to be a risk. And so what has happened over time is EPA has changed their labels and they've changed the crops it can be used on. And then what ended up happening is organizations like PAN sometimes work together to bring lawsuits to try and force the EPA to change how things are set. So PAN has been doing multiple lawsuits on chlorpyrifos, and finally one of those came to fruition in 2021. And essentially what that did is that directed the EPA to set no tolerance levels for food. In other words, you can't have any chlorpyrifos in any food in the United States.
Whoopee!
Oh my goodness.
Okay. Now this is great. Okay, in 2021 we were celebrating this. So essentially what that means is that anything that was a feed or food crop, you can't use chlorpyrifos on. But in the state of Iowa, we grow a lot of seed crops and a lot of crops for ethanol. So if they wanted to use chlorpyrifos on those, they certainly can, and they did. But the point is this was a step towards removing chlorpyrifos.
Well, that was a small dent. This is KHOI, and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen. Find out more at www.khoifm.org. Welcome back. We're talking to Rob Fox.
Yeah, and he's talking about, say that word again,
chlorpyrifos.
Chlorpyrifos. Okay, so it got banned, but that's not the end of the story. Then what happened?
Yeah, you're right. That's not the end of the story. Essentially, FDA was actually going through the process of removing registrations of products that use this chemical in it as the active pesticide or insecticide. Unfortunately, in November of 23, another court overturned that ruling. So now this ban is no longer in effect for the FDA. Or I should say EPA. I got the wrong letters in there all of a sudden. But here's the thing. We're always fighting this battle, and it goes back and forth all the time.
In
so
court.
Once again, PAN is on the case. One of the things you as individuals can do is everybody could go to PANA's website, PANNA.org, and if you go there, you'll notice that we have an action center. There's the words take action. And if you go there, there are some actions we have, including one that says that the EPA should reinstate this chlorpyrifos ban. And what happens is we collect your letters, you know, essentially you're writing a letter and send it to the EPA for you. So you don't have to figure out who to send it to. You don't have to figure out the words you want to write. You can certainly modify what you write. You're allowed to go in there and change the letter if you want to add something to it or change some words. But we make it easy for you to contact the EPA and say, hey, this is not what we want. We have other actions in addition to that. So. Yeah, and that's basically this is who has to protect us right now is organizations like PAN, and PAN is not the only one, are trying to be the counterbalance to the large industry who are also trying to tell the EPA what they want.
And they have a lot of money to do that, right?
They have a lot of money, yes. Organizations like PAN do not have a lot of money. So this is where we rely on individuals such as yourselves, anyone who's listening, to go and at least try and amplify our voices together by everybody sending that letter to the EPA saying, hey, we actually liked the fact that you had this no tolerance level for chlorpyrifos because we are all in agreement that chlorpyrifos is a dangerous chemical and we need to stop using it so much.
So the legal system,
that's kind of where we're at.
The legal system is the only place where these bans are being fought?
Well, the legal system is not the only place. That is correct, because we also sometimes we will create actions that try to tell our legislators that we've got bills that we would like them to pass. For example, there is a bill to try and ban organophosphates out there right now.
So what are organophosphates?
Organophosphates are a class of pesticides that are often considered some of the most likely to drift and some of the most dangerous to human health. And they would include things like chlorpyrifos. So it's basically a larger ban. It's not just chlorpyrifos, mm-hmm, but it includes mm-hmm. other chemicals in that class. There's another bill called PACTPA, Protect America's Children, essentially is what it is, from pesticides. And
is that the one where they say you can't spray around the schoolyard playgrounds and stuff like that?
It includes some things like that, but it also includes language to try and prevent loopholes that allow pesticides to continue to be used even though it's been demonstrated that they're dangerous. It would encourage more review of pesticides, because what it is right now is it's pretty easy to get a pesticide registration approved, and it's really hard to get it taken away. And so part of the legislation is to change from a system that tends to say, let's go ahead and run this pesticide out into the world and see what it does, versus let's make sure this pesticide is safe before we run it out into the world to see what it does. So PACTPA turns it back around to a protection principle where you're trying to say, hey, you need to show us this thing is truly and very much safe before you start using.
Sounds like a good thing.
So where does glyphosate fit into all that? That's something we have a lot of around here on soybeans.
Yeah, glyphosate is used. It's the most popular herbicide on the market even now, even though there's some concern that it doesn't work as well as it used to in some of the fields because we've overused it. As far as glyphosate is concerned, there is getting to be a little bit more knowledge about the dangers of that product. In that case, I would say that there's more action on the court side, mm-hmm. on litigation, than there is on legislative side. And a lot of that has been personal damages. I think you probably have heard of some of the cases where people have been awarded damages. And of course, per the norm, those cases get tied up in appeals. But so far, courts have continued to support the fact that Monsanto, now Bayer, is responsible for all those damages. So it may be years before these things finish. For example, we had a case, PAN was involved in a case with other organizations that started in 2011, and it just now in September 23 got a ruling that said that the EPA needs to protect endangered species from pesticides. In other words, they have to have plans to try and make sure endangered species are not being damaged by the pesticides we're using. Up to this point, they haven't had to do that.
It seems, the even the victories or the steps toward victories are very small, but we are awfully glad. So this is what farmers can spend their time doing besides growing wonderful crops for us. And thank you for this information. Could you give us the information on how people can find the PAN website and the organization and the way people can take action again?
Yeah, the address for the website is panna.org, PANNA.org. And you will find at the top that there's a thing that says Take Action. And if you click on that, it will take you to a page. And you'll find all of our currently active letter-writing campaigns that we have that you as an individual can take part in.
That's great. We've been talking to Rob Fox, and he's been talking about his history and his journey through learning about pesticides affecting him.
I have to say it's, you know, living in Iowa where a lot of this is going on very heavily all around us, it's a bit gruesome. I think the first step, though, is since we can't see it, we can't hear it, we can't feel it, to educate oneself and be aware of it and take actions when you can with your legislators, with your who knows where to begin. But it is a problem.
It is a problem. And people like Rob and Pesticide Action Network are a good place to start. That's good. Thank you for being
with
us.
Thank you, Rob.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for all the work that you do.
I appreciate that. It's always a pleasure to be in your show.
Okay.
Good. Well, I have a little bit of a poem here to share, and it's from a poet, a writer, and obviously quite a influential person named Liberty Hyde Bailey.
Yes, so Liberty Hyde Bailey, who was born in 1858 and lived until 1954, was an American horticulturist, basically based at Cornell. He's kind of considered the father of rural sociology. He was one of the main founders of all the Ag Extension Network all over the country and 4-H. And he wrote extensively. And so Lana's going to read a little excerpt from something he wrote.
Yes, because everyone's been kind of commenting on the weather lately because we have got winter in spades. Yes, we do. But winter is not just problems with starting your car. Winter is a pretty amazing thing. And we can be glad that we live in a part of the country that does have the change of seasons. And here is a little excerpt from some writings from Liberty Hyde Bailey called From an Outlook on Winter. Winter is the best season of the four because there's more mystery in it. There is a new and strange spirit in the air. There are strange bird calls in the depths of the still white woods. There are strange markers in the new falling snow. There are soft noises when the snow drops from the trees, and there are grotesque figures on the old fence. There's a warm brown pathway of the brook still winding up between the oozing banks. In the spring, there are troops of flower gatherers along the brook. In the summer, there are fishers. In the fall, there are nut gatherers. In the winter, the brook and I are alone. We know. That's a little bit on some of the joys of winter. And I found that on something that Mary Swander puts out. She has something called the Substack, and she has something called, well, she is talking about and making sure that Iowa writers are available to us also. Thanks to Mary Swander for sharing that with us. She has a website or a podcast called Mary Swander's Buggy Land, and you can find her.
Yeah, you can find all of Mary Swander's works on her website, AgArts, AGARTS, and there's never a dull moment with Mary, so do
Very
check
good.
It out.
Very good, so stay warm out there. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. We come to you every Tuesday at noon and 7 p.m. We had music by the Barnall Band. Support this fine community radio station. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
Great engineering by Mike Murphy. Eat good food and enjoy life.